Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Cancer Conference Update. As today we're going to focus on the recent ESMO meeting that was held in Berlin. We're going to be talking about urothelial bladder cancer and prostate cancer and what happened at that meeting. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Terry Friedlander from the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of California, San Francisco in San Francisco, and Dr. Raina McKay from the Moores Cancer Center in the University of California, San Diego in San Diego, California. We're here today to kind of unravel what happened at the ESMO Congress, particularly in these two cancers. And I would say a lot. There's a lot to talk about. I actually met with each faculty person prior to this. And just to mention also that, as always, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and regimens. So check out the official prescribing information for more. Here's where we're heading. We're going to spend the first half of this talking about prostate cancer and the second half talking about urothelial bladder cancer. And over the last couple of weeks, I met with each of the faculty individually and recorded a series of short videos. We're into short form video. We've been doing that a lot since the pandemic, and we'll be distributing these in the next few weeks as a prelude to this webinar being put out as well. So Dr. McKay talked about prostate cancer, and she'll be kind of the lead tonight on that. But we'll also get into urothelial bladder cancer with Dr. Friedlander and the slides that he presented. So let's start out with prostate cancer. And of course, last night we had a webinar on breast cancer, and I was telling them I can't wait for today to hear what you all have to say about capivasertib, because of course we've been talking with the breast cancer people a lot about that and AKT inhibition for several years now. And actually, we did a program at the AUA last year on AKT inhibition in anticipation of knowing this trial was going to come out. We actually had Hope Rugo, a breast cancer investigator, that we video recorded and had her talking about some of the tolerability issues that come up in this situation, because it's very new for GU oncology. So really interested to see what you think about this. And of course, Raina, here are all the papers that Raina went through. And the first one here is this Capitella 281 study. And Raina, you know, maybe we can talk a little bit about what was seen here. I guess there were two issues for me that came out, and you go into this so well in the short video that we did about this trial. This is a randomized study comparing Capi plus abiraterone to abiraterone alone, hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. These are people with P10 deficiencies. So this is different than breast cancer. You pick three mutations, et cetera. This is a different, same agent, but kind of different molecular alteration. We did see, the trial met its endpoint. They did see statistically significant benefit of PFS. The hazard rate was a modest 0.81, but also at this point kind of early in terms of survival. So modest benefit. These people had to have 90% of their cells stained with IHC that showed this P10 deficiency. But they also showed greater benefit as the P10 level went up. So you needed 90% to get in, but then they showed 95 and 100%. When you get up to 100%, then hazard rate is down 0.68, so a little bit better. But we'll see how this all pans out. And we want to ask Raina, she has a case or a case scenario, actually, that she's going to talk about. I think the tolerability was kind of what was expected. I was curious about hyperglycemia because these people are also getting the prednisone with abiraterone. And it kind of looks similar to what we've seen with breast cancer, potential for rash and hyperglycemia as well. But one of the things that came out there, just to get started before we get into whether it's prime time yet for Capitella and prostate cancer, Raina, was what they talked about as in terms of the nature of the cases of patients with P10 deficiency. So they showed that 25% of the patients they screened actually were positive, greater than 90%. So it's not a rare, finding. But they also showed that the PFS of the control group, if you just saw the curve that just went by, was only 2 years for hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. So pretty negative prognosis there. And the other thing that Dr. Fazazi talked about, I did a program with him around the time of the AUA meeting. I was trying to get the results out of him, but he wouldn't tell me. So I can't wait to talk to him now that he just presented it. But one of the things that also came out was the phenotype of this RENA, where he said in the presentation that they often see imaging progression or clinical progression without PSA going up. And of course, the other thing was this very negative PFS. So any thoughts? First of all, RENA, do you think that whether or not you're going to use CAPI, it makes sense to get a P10 assay or to look at P10 at first diagnosis, if nothing else, for prognosis?
Very good questions. You know, I think that is one of the key takeaways for this trial is I think now we are standardly doing molecular profiling for people with advanced metastatic disease. I think it's critically important to make sure that every patient, even if they're metastatic hormone sensitive, actually undergoes both germline and somatic tumor profiling so you can plan ahead what you're going to do for that given individual. And I think actually understanding that these P10 deficient patients can have a worse prognosis and that you probably need to be imaging them at a more regular clip than what is typically done in practice in the MHSPC setting is critically important. These aren't people that you're just going to only follow their PSA and not get a scan for 2 years. You know, you kind of want to periodically be scanning them, whether every 6 to 12 months or some regular frequency. Because I think this trial highlighted that there many individuals can progress with a non-progressing PSA, but progress on scans.
So again, before we get into the issue of CAPI or not, Terry, again, you know, we see all, in breast cancer that we did last night, we talked about HER2 positive, ER positive, triple negative, molecular subsetting, lung cancer molecular subsetting. To me, I mean, of course, we needed BRCA and all, you know, to look for a PARP, but I think this became a big part. This could become a big part of initial approach. Actually, Terry's at the DAVA conference in the Bermuda now. I guess you have a whole bunch of GU thought leaders there. What are they saying down there about this study in terms of, again, the prognostic impact? Maybe these patients, Raina and I were saying, would you be more likely to give chemo to a patient like this? And also, what was the sentiment about whether CAPI is sort of ready for prime time, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's enthusiasm because the study was positive. And, you know, I think we're seeing, as Raina said, that we're able to start molecularly subsetting prostate cancer patients and really find, you know, markers of poor prognosis. You know, this study, while it was positive, as you said, it was, you know, maybe sort of modestly positive with a hazard ratio of 0.81. You know, and you showed the toxicity table, you know, there are real toxicities to this and patients have to stay on it for a long time. And so I think that there's, you know, there's some muted enthusiasm for it. I'm not sure it's totally ready for prime time. I'd love to see the survival benefit here because there was no survival benefit, at least at ESMO, that, you know, and the study's immature. So I do think that identifying these subsets is good, knowing that their poor prognosis is helpful, you know, because they really are. Maybe giving them chemo earlier will help. I think that needs to be tested better. So I we'll see if this drug gets approved. I'm not sure, you know, a patient has to be pretty fit to tolerate all those side effects.
Yeah, and I think the doc needs to be ready too. You know, again, when we were preparing this program for a urologist, I was thinking, okay, the oncologists, they know about capivasertib, but the urologists, you know, this is a totally new thing. And, you know, we've seen there's a real art to using this drug, RENA. And I, you know, I've had the feeling as I've been talking to people over the last few years that investigators who use it a lot more, you know, maybe have a lot less toxicity. There are a lot of situations in oncology where you see modest benefits and yet agents are approved. We use them as SERDs are a good example in breast cancer. Not, you know, the greatest efficacy, PFS of 5 months, but very, very well tolerated. And I was thinking that, you know, as people maybe get more experience with CAPI and we see more data, it may be better tolerated and people in risk benefit might look better. You put together a series of scenarios, kind of reminds me, everybody always says our stuff is like the boards, and I've been taking the boards just to keep an eye on what they're doing. This is exactly like the boards. So you constructed these board-like scenarios. Can you talk about the scenario that you created here with a 66-year-old man and how you generally would think about managing the case before you saw this data and whether or not, if you could, you would actually use CAPI in a patient like this? So what was the scenario you put together?
Yeah, so this is a gentleman that I think is commonly seen in the clinic. 66-year-old gentleman presents with de novo metastatic high-volume disease. We're seeing a lot more de novo metastatic disease, given that there's been a lot of confusion around PSA screening and kind of people kind of moving away from PSA screening in the clinic. So we've actually seen tremendous stage migration. He presents with de novo high-volume disease, reflective of most of our MHSPC studies. 80% of patients present like that. He had a biopsy that's done. His PSA was very elevated, 287, had a biopsy done showing Gleason 9 disease. And he had high volume based off of charted criteria with, multiple bony metastases. Also was found to have some lung metastases. And I think we're really trying to better understand lung metastases and prostate cancer because they don't have the same trajectory like liver metastases and are genomically somewhat unique when we look at liver versus lung. They were subtle, not very large, but there and clearly suggestive of, a high volume disease per charted. As part of routine practice, now in guidelines, it's recommended that patients with advanced metastatic disease undergo genomic profiling, germline testing, and somatic tumor profiling. This individual had a genomic test done with a tissue-based test based off of the prostate biopsy that was done that demonstrated molecular P10 loss. Now, in routine clinical practice, we're not necessarily doing IHC staining. This is not part of, routine pathology labs reporting out on this, and none of the molecular vendors will report out on P10 loss specifically for a prostate patient. So I think for the context of, thinking about, the trial, would you want to get confirmation by P10 IHC? I think probably in clinical practice, I don't necessarily think you need the IHC confirmation. I think that's the trial was done with a integral biomarker of IHC by P10 loss. So this
you're going to see it on NGS. Breast cancer, you get it on the NGS, and people are used to doing that, and probably that'd be fine.
Sufficient.
Another thing, too, here, you put down there, monitor glucose. And as we've been hearing these things in breast, this drug being used in breast, we had a case presented the other day, and the oncologist said, gave the patient CAPI. The patient had a lot of problems with glucose. And I said, did you get a hemoglobin A1C? And she said, yeah, and it was 7. So I sent the patient to the endocrinologist. But meanwhile, 7 is, diabetes. And so you got to be all over that if you see that. So we actually, believe it or not, this has been my dream for the last 2 years, are about to do a program, Diabetology for the Medical Oncologist.
I love that.
This came out of what was going on with PIC3, but now, you guys need to know about it as well. So I can't wait to hear what they say about continuous glucose monitoring and how we're going to minimize it. The CAPI schedule also, is 4 days on, 3 off, which is ameliorates toxicity. Maybe in the future, we're going to manipulate that as well. So, a very striking presentation. This to me is a big movement, and whether or not CAPI comes through here or not, I think just the awareness that a patient like this, not only do they have a lot of disease, but they've got a P10 loss, which means you maybe ought to be a little bit more thoughtful, maybe think even more about chemotherapy. You were saying you think there's some data showing that maybe people benefit more from chemo who are P10 deficient, Raina?
Yeah, there's this really elegant work that's been done by Emily Grist that's just recently published from the STAMPEDE data set that looked at P10 sensitivity or P10 loss signature and looking at it with regards to sensitivity to docetaxel chemotherapy. And those are the patients that do, in fact, seem to derive benefit from docetaxel chemo. Now, this was STAMPEDE that was just looking at ADT dosi, not triplet therapy, but I think the data are quite provocative.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about PARP inhibitors. Of course, we saw the big trial at ASCO looking at niraparib and hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. But at ESMO, we also saw some data on a new PARP inhibitor, Raina saruparib, and that's also in a trial looking at hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. And we also saw data from the telazoprib enzalutamide TELEPRO 2 study. Anything you want to say about, first of all, saruparib, why is it different than other PARP inhibitors? And what are your thoughts? We see, again, we're starting to see some early data with this. What do we know about the benefit-risk ratio in this agent?
Yeah, you know, this is a selective PARP1 inhibitor, and I think a lot of the toxicity that we think is related to, PARP, general PARP, unselected PARP1-2 inhibitors is really that PARP2 activity, which can potentially worsen the cytopenias and anemias that are seen. And so it's nice to have potentially a alternate agent that is quite potent with regards to its PARP1 activity and then limited PARP2. So I think it's exciting to see other PARP inhibitors entering into the landscape. I think this trial was quite heterogeneous with regards to the patients that enrolled, people that had mCRPC that were RP naive, people that were RP exposed, and they even had an mHSPC cohort. And I think really the main message is that this drug is safe and safe given in combination and monotherapy with ADT and an RP and has a very manageable toxicity profile. You know, this trial, I think it's going to be hard to glean efficacy data from that study.
So we'll look forward to seeing the data on that. And then again, we saw some follow-up from the Talipro 2 study. But what I really want to get into is what are you doing today in terms of use of PARP inhibitors? And again, you put together this scenario. Can you go through this and what your thoughts are about when you use a PARP inhibitor, how you use it, and what you see when patients are getting PARP inhibitors?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually in totality, when we look at the data, early PARP seems to do better. These patients have, they can have that synthetic lethality when you integrate the early PARP inhibition, particularly those that have BRCA1-2 alterations. So I think thinking about that is key, and the data has really demonstrated that. So this is a 63-year-old individual, was diagnosed initially with localized disease, had Gleason 8, PSA 18, T3A, didn't have stampede high risk, had definitive treatment with radiation and hormones, which is very common in many of our patients. He did well after treatment, nadired his PSA to 0.34, keeping in mind this is a radiation patient, so he's not necessarily going to get to a undetectable PSA. And then, PSA started to rise and actually rise quite rapidly, and then underwent imaging and actually was found to have some retroperitoneal nodes and had some low volume sclerotic disease throughout his bones. He was castrate. He wasn't, he didn't have a, I think we skipped over the point of him having ADT on the prior slide. So if you go back a slide, he had initially developed ADT or developed metastatic disease, started ADT, had a great response to ADT, was on it for a year and a half. He was on ADT monotherapy, which is not common practice. The reason for the ADT monotherapy was he had metachronous disease. It was low volume at the time. And so I think these are patients that we still encounter in clinical practice who haven't necessarily gotten an RP for mHSPC. And then unfortunately had a short course of therapy with the ADT, progressed within 2 years with a rising PSA and worsening disease. And it's then at that time that he ends up undergoing genomic profiling, and he's found to have a BRCA2 alteration, which kind of in hindsight, in its germline, kind of in hindsight, speaks to his aggressive presentation over the, within a decade, basically presenting with metastatic disease. And this is a perfect patient for doublet RP and a PARP inhibitor, olaparib, abiraterone. He's RP naive. He's BRCA2 mutated. This is exactly who you want to give a doublet to like this.
And Terry, I'm curious what your experience has been with tolerability and side effects with PARP inhibitors. This patient had fatigue, anemia, actually had a dose hold, but then resumed at the same dose. How often you end up using dose reduction with PARP? Any comments on how people tolerate it?
Yeah, I would say they're not the easiest. Men with prostate cancer, especially CRPC, tend to be a little more elderly than, for example, women with breast cancer who are eligible for these agents, or ovarian cancer. So they don't tolerate it as well. GI is the other, you know, major side effect for these. Some diarrhea can be a problem. So I've had a sort of similar experience here. You know, when I'd counsel patients about this, I used to say this was targeted therapy. This is oral. It's different. And now I just say this is an oral form of chemotherapy. It will, you know, should work against your cancer. But I think it's good to educate patients and have them understand that this is not just a simple hormone pill. There really are toxicities and we have to monitor for it.
So, of course, the question I want to ask you, Raina, is ideally, where do you think PARP inhibitors are going to fit in? Do you think, you know, we're starting to see data, hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. Do you think that's where things are going to land? Are we there now?
You know, I have to say, I think the Amplitude data that were presented at ASCO, we are very close to being there for a BRCA1/2 mutated individual with metastatic hormone-sensitive disease. I think these are the patients that derive benefit. I think we still need a little bit of follow-up data on toxicity and sort of just the OS signal, but this is exactly who I would treat with a PARP inhibitor. And even moving in the localized setting, you know, we have studies now with EvoPAR2 that's looking at testing adjuvant saruparib for a finite period of time for those high-risk individuals that are BRCA1/2 mutated, either somatic or germline, following receipt of radiation therapy. So I think this is where we can potentially change the natural history of the disease. Can you increase the cure rate by early utilization in a highly select population that we know is responsive to the drug?
And, of course, in breast cancer, adjuvant olaparib is given often mm-hmm. in these patients, again, with BRCA mutations. Let's move on to biochemically recurrent prostate cancer, one of my favorite trials of all time, not just in GU oncology, but in oncology. I love the EMBARK study. There's so many different reasons. And I hear that this update actually got a standing ovation at ESMO. But in any event, now we're seeing survival benefit. I think everybody's familiar with the EMBARK study that looked at both the combination of enzalutamide and ADT, as well as enzalutamide alone. Of course, much better data with the combination there. And now we're seeing a survival benefit, hazard rate of 0.44, Raina. Pretty impressive. I don't know how many biochemically recurrent patients there are anymore with PSMA testing, but any thoughts about the data here and the implications? And, you know, also to me, and we saw data also with enzalutamide monotherapy, not statistically significant, but again, look better than ADT alone in any event. I'm just kind of curious how you're thinking about this at this time. Do you ever use enzalutamide monotherapy? And we saw some data also, the follow-up with the PRESTO study wasn't as big. I think it was a phase 2 study looking at apalutamide plus abiraterone. And I don't think people have really latched onto that as much. But you have this case that you put together, this scenario of a patient who really does have biochemical relapse and negative imaging, and you said, well, theoretically, the patient, this scenario maybe could go on enzalutamide alone. So, Raina, what were your thoughts about these survival data, and how are you thinking about managing these patients nowadays? Do you ever use enzalutamide alone?
Yes to all the above. I think this is absolutely a practice-changing trial on so many levels, and I'm actively using enzalutamide and ADT for these high-risk individuals. And in some scenarios for individuals who have some aversion to ADT or have risk factors, yes, enzalutamide monotherapy. So I think that this is really... the overall survival benefit is absolutely dramatic. And what I tell my patients about the intensification, and actually why I tend to lean more towards the doublet as opposed to the single monotherapy, is when you follow these patients, their average time off therapy is close to 2 years from when they stop. And so that's a really important thing for people to consider, whereas the monotherapy patients within a year, they're back on therapy, their PSA is rising, they're dealing with the, you know, consequences of that, you know, rise in PSA and what am I going to do and going back on treatment. And so I actually think that affording a 2-year, you know, average time off treatment before you need to consider a rechallenge is actually huge for patients. And so, and when you look at the toxicity profile, you know, the combination is largely pretty well managed, and the tox profile compared to monotherapy isn't really all that dramatically different. I think this data are groundbreaking.
Yeah, you know, in CLL, we're doing a program at ASH on CLL, of course, and there they've been talking about time-limited therapy. But I hear oncologists now applying it, you know, outside of CLL. Here's a case of your case here. Patient gets a year or maybe 2 years, as you were saying, enzalutamide, then stops. That's very different than the previous standard, so to speak, of ADT indefinitely or until progression. Mm-hmm. So, again, so many practice-changing things came up, and this is another gigantic one. PSMA addition trial, the hormone-sensitive space is getting more and more crowded. I have no idea how you're going to end up sorting all this out. But here we look at the use of lutetium, hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. We do see a benefit. Again, PFS has a rate about 0.72. I'm curious, you were telling me they haven't quite got to discussing that at the DAVA conference there, Terry, but I'm kind of curious what you're hearing in terms of, are people ready to do this? And this, Serena put together a scenario where she actually would have a patient like this and would give lutetium plus endocrine therapy. What are you hearing from your colleagues? Yeah. What are your thoughts, Terry?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of enthusiasm. I mean, the lutetium PSMA is very effective in both the mCRPC space as well as in the mCSPC space based on this trial. You know, the challenge is the study was sort of monolithic. Everyone got 6 doses, you know, one dose per month. It doesn't really tailor therapy. So if a patient had 1 or 2 metastases versus, you know, a super scan where they had a whole, you know, every bone was full of cancer, they didn't really distinguish, you know, they didn't break those patients up by treatment or give them different doses of therapy. I think there's ways of giving this medicine that maybe isn't so regimented. I do worry about a little bit about the longer-term toxicity. We don't have long-term follow-up for bone marrow toxicity, for MDS, for, you know, other problems. So, I mean, it's a positive study, and I think we're going to use it. I think we're going to see it be used a lot, and I think it's beneficial. But I would like to see longer-term toxicity. Are people going to get leukemia from this? Like, what's going to happen down the road that now that men are living so much longer?
So, Raina, anything you want to add to that? And also maybe a quick comment on the Enzerad study. So many positive trials, but here, kind of surprisingly, you know, I always heard the clinical idea or research idea that the earlier you intensify endocrine therapy, the better. You're going to see greater response. But here, we didn't exactly see that. Can you talk about what was seen here, what they looked at, and what do you think it means?
Yeah, you know, I actually think this was a really, really, really important study because I think it made us all pause. Because I think in prior settings, we've had this notion of, well, anytime you give a high-risk patient an ARPI, they're going to benefit. Anytime you give a high-risk patient an ARPI, they're going to benefit. Well, in actuality, maybe not. And, you know, this was a trial that took patients that had bona fide NCCN high-risk disease by Gleason, any one of the factors, Gleason, PSA, or stage, and randomized them to Enza. Now, the control arm here did get an NSAA, like bicalutamide, for the duration of the time. It wasn't just ADT alone. It was a, you know, similar to what was done in Enzamet. They gave a first-generation anti-androgen. Now, I'm not saying that that's why we see the results that we see, but these patients do really well. And, you know, even though the trial was negative, I think when you actually start to slice the data apart and look at the highest risk group, look at the people that had no positive disease, look at the people that got pelvic radiation, which is a surrogate of somebody having a bias that they were higher risk to get pelvic nodal radiation. Those were the patients that derived benefit. So I think we need to just be cautious. Like, ARPIs aren't for everybody with high risk disease. I think Enzerad really drove that message home for me, at least.
So again, this is kind of like a tasting menu. Check out the videos that we're about to send out for more details. Just trying to give you a little bit of an overview of some of the things that came out at ESMO. And urothelial bladder cancer, also lots of really interesting, relevant stuff. Here are the papers that Terry went through in my session with him. A lot of really interesting, very clinically relevant data. Terry, what about this perioperative enfortumab plus pembro? I think that was maybe one of the most anticipated papers that was being presented. It was a late-breaking abstract. Can you talk about the background for this and what they saw?
Sure. So this KEYNOTE-905 trial is a study of perioperative enfortumab, vedotin, and pembrolizumab. This regimen has already been shown to be better than platinum-based chemotherapy for metastatic disease, and it's the standard of care here in the U.S. and really worldwide. And so the question was, giving this, what's the benefit of giving this both neoadjuvantly and adjuvantly? So patients got sandwich therapy, 3 cycles of neoadjuvant EVP, 9 cycles of adjuvant, and then continued the pembro for up to a year. And as you can see here, when you look at event-free survival, the hazard ratio is 0.4. So that's a dramatic difference in the likelihood of recurrence. You know, this is what we expected in a way because the data look quite similar in the metastatic setting. And you can see the overall survival was a hazard ratio of 0.5. So this really, I should say this study was done in patients who were cisplatin ineligible and the control arm just got surgery alone. They were allowed to get adjuvant nivolumab. That was an amendment on the trial. So again, this is treatment versus essentially no therapy except for the surgery. But nonetheless, this patient population who were cisplatin ineligible traditionally had no therapeutic options except surgery, and outcomes and prognosis were really poor. I also should point out the average age in this study was 73 years old, and most of these patients had advanced disease T3, T4. So this was a poor-risk patient population. We're seeing a really dramatic benefit. And I think, you know, this is in front of the FDA soon, but I think this is very likely to become the standard of care for perioperative therapy.
Yeah, really amazing to see a survival benefit, even disease-free survival, but then survival in a neoadjuvant study. So, Raina, any thoughts about how this is going to play out clinically? I'm still waiting for somebody to present me a case of somebody who gets EV pembro who doesn't have a rash. I kind of feel like I'm sure there must be some patients, but they never get presented to me. How much of an issue is toxicity? I mean, it's nice not to use platinum, but on the other hand, isn't that necessarily a benign regimen? What's your experience, Raina?
You know, I have to say, you know, EV pembro is a, not to say fairly easy regimen to give. There's lots of things to monitor for, but I don't think it's any more challenging to deal with than platinum plus, you know, gemcitabine or, you know, one of the other regimens that we would use. I think, you know, I know, Terry, you're going to talk about this. I think that we're going to start to see, like, creeping of this regimen into the, you know, platinum eligible.
Yep.
Group because the data just looks so good, you yeah. know, and
yeah, there's a separate trial, the EV304 Keynote B15 that's evaluating that regimen in the cisplatin eligible population. I will say, Neil, one of the major criticisms of the study is that, you know, this was a sandwich approach and there was no evaluation of the components, contribution of components in the adjuvant space. And as, you know, Raina was just saying, you know, EV has toxicity. And the question is, do you really need to give it in the adjuvant space? I think the answer for now is yes. But we have to be really thoughtful about that because if we're going to cure these patients and they're going to live with lifelong, you know, grade 2 neuropathy, that's going to be a problem.
So you have access. So these are actual patients that you have that you're going to present here, Terry. You have a 66-year-old man. Let me just ask you, are people, I mean, with those kind of numbers, are people ready to jump into platinum eligible or are they going to wait for the data?
Well, so actually, the study allowed patients who were platinum eligible but refusing. So 16% of the study arm had technically cisplatin eligible disease by the Galski criteria. So there is sort of a small pathway. There was no real subset analysis. It wasn't powered to say what the benefit is. But I think that, you know, it's platinum is a tough drug, hearing loss, you know, creatinine, and other issues. And some of our patients have modest performance status. So, you know, I think we need to get this regimen approved, but I think we'll start seeing it very likely used even before we have the results of 304. And hopefully that study will show a similar magnitude of benefit.
So you're somewhat ahead of time in a lot of things, Terry. This patient actually got treated, a year and a half ago with the same regimen before this was actually presented, what happened with the patient. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the imaging here, too.
Sure. This patient had node positive disease at baseline and a tumor in the bladder and was cisplatin ineligible. And so, by creatinine and, had this variant histology, sarcomatoid macropapillary. And I met him and I said, look, this is bad news. You know, your likelihood of developing metastases is incredibly high. And he said, isn't there anything better? We said, well, with the node positive, we could call this locally advanced. And we did. And we gave four cycles of EVP. He had the exact toxicity you're talking about, rash, pruritus, fortunately treatable with steroids, underwent a radical cystectomy, and was, to my surprise, was in a complete response, had no negative disease, and cell-free DNA was negative. And so we talked about what to do, should we give more therapy or not, as I just mentioned a minute ago. And we elected to do it. He had more EV toxicity, and he may be cured. It's like almost a year out or maybe longer. He does have some chronic, maybe autoimmune toxicity as this intermittent fever syndrome that we're working up. And so it's not without cost. But, this is a guy I would not predict would have had an excellent response and have his bladder out and maybe be cured.
So Priya, a medical oncologist in the chat room, says she's had a patient who's been on EV Pembro for a year, no rash. So I'm glad to hear somebody doesn't get a rash. Yeah. Also, Hassan, our chat room always brings up cell-free DNA, and we're going to talk a lot because some really cool data presented on cell-free DNA. But what about in this situation, Terry, cell-free DNA post-neoadjuvant? You mentioned the fact this man was cell-free DNA. Do you think that's maybe we don't have perfect data, but enough of a clue to maybe affect your decision-making?
Yeah, I think here in the U.S. where we can get it pretty readily, most of the trials are using the Signatera test from Natera. The data is pretty strong. Patients who are cell-free DNA positive almost uniformly will relapse. So it's a good prognostic marker. Patients who are cell-free DNA negative, depending what study you look at, probably have a 20 or 30% chance of relapse. So it's a good prognostic marker. The IMvigor 011 study was also presented at ESMO and also suggested that you can use that to decide who to treat. And if you see a positive finding, you should treat them. Didn't really tell us what to do with the negative patients. But I'm getting it very frequently now in the perioperative setting and in the metastatic setting. I think of it almost like a PSA for bladder cancer. It's a personalized, bespoke assay that can really tell us if there's residual cancer or cancer cells, and it seems to be performing really well.
Yeah, we've had some interesting discussions with Dr. Pals over the last few years about that, and we're really looking forward to see this data because it looked like it was coming for a while. We also saw some follow-up data, Terry, at ESMO from the Niagara study. This made big news about a year ago, big paper in the New England Journal, neoadjuvant chemo with durvalumab, which was a positive study. Of course, we showed the ESMO paper with EV Pembro, and we'll talk about how that fits in. But can you talk a little bit about what they looked at with Niagara, what they saw with this update?
Sure.
And I think you have a case of a patient who got the treatment.
Yeah, so Niagara was in the cisplatin-eligible population and randomized patients to get GemCis or GemCis plus durvalumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor. If after surgery, they continued durvalumab for up to a year. So fairly straightforward study, and you can see the likelihood of having a pathologic complete response was higher, it was 37% compared to 27%. So the durvalumab clearly has benefit here. There was also benefits in terms of EFS. It was sort of modest, I would say. I mean, the hazard ratio here is 0.68, so it's real, but there was an OS benefit here as well. So as of today in 2025 in November, this regimen is the standard of care for cisplatin-eligible patients here in the U.S. What we're really waiting for now is for the EV-304 Canopy-15 trial, which is looking at EVP in the same patient population, very similar to the study we just talked about. It's not directly comparing to, the Niagara regimen. It's comparing to GemCis, which was the standard of care and has been for 30 years. So I think we're going to have to do cross-trial comparisons, as fraught as that is. But if we see a really impressive hazard ratio for 304, then perhaps Niagara will not be as commonly used. If it's less impressive, then maybe there'll be a role for both of those regimens. There was an update as well.
Data, right.
Yeah, looking at health-related quality of life. And you can see overall there wasn't much of a difference adding durvalumab. To me, this wasn't a major surprise. You know, most studies of checkpoint inhibitors have not shown major changes in health-related quality of life. And this is a patient I had who just, you know, in the last year who I treated. I can tell you about her. She had chronic eczema, and she was already on immunosuppressives for this. She was found to have a tumor in the lower ureter. The pathology was high-grade carcinoma. It was invasive. It, you know, looked ugly. There was no metastatic disease, but there was lymphovascular invasion. So high risk. I think we can go to the next slide. She wasn't a good candidate for chemo radiation. She was comfortable with getting the surgery. We talked with dermatology about the eczema. We ended up treating her with Niagara regimen. She actually did well. She had pathologic downstaging, and now we're following her in the adjuvant setting. She has had trouble with the durvalumab, as many people have with checkpoint inhibitors when they have baseline autoimmunity. And so we're now trying to manage the psoriatic plaque. That's sort of where things stand. But overall, you know, has done pretty well. I think I should say the tumor at the time of surgery was T3. So that's actually not great. We've elected to just continue the durvalumab rather than switch. We don't really have great data on switching therapy just based on this sort of finding. So far, you know, patient's doing well, so, you know, hasn't had relapse, and we're just trying to manage the skin toxicity.
And I see here too, she's ctDNA negative, which I think is also reassuring in terms of keeping the durvalumab going. You know, as things evolve here in the perioperative space, and maybe we're going to see, you know, positive data in the platinum eligible with EV Pembro. One of the things I was thinking about, and I don't know, Raina, how often you run into it, is a patient with pre-existing neuropathy. They have diabetes, they have some significant peripheral neuropathy. How concerned are you about using EV in a patient like that? Do you think in that situation in the future, or even now, you'd lean more towards Niagara?
You know, I think it's a very good question. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be a balancing act between the degree of efficacy and what is the likelihood of long-term cure versus the complications from the peripheral neuropathy. And then it's not like you're going to be without peripheral neuropathy with Niagara. You still got your cisplatinum, which you're still is going to put somebody at risk of peripheral neuropathy. So I think, you know, peripheral neuropathy is challenging. And I think the biggest questions that I have around it aren't so much should they get, you know, EV Pembro, yes, no, but rather how much should they get and how long should they get it for, and should they continue to get it on a Q3-week basis for the entire time that they're on it if they have a major pathologic response. Like, you know, these are sort of the different things that I think we need to kind of finesse around. You know, it's not necessarily the maximum tolerated dose, but how do we get to the maximal, like the minimum optimal dose is really what we're trying to do. And I don't think we've really done that with EV yet.
So Terry, as a medical oncologist, I've always been fascinated by the Pretzel, TAR-200 and the other TAR agents. I mean, I'm an oncologist, don't necessarily have that much to do with intravesicular treatment unless there's an IO involved. Anything you would say about the Sunrise-4 data presented at ESMO looking at this?
Yeah, so TAR-200 is essentially a bio material that's impregnated with gemcitabine that can be given into the bladder so urologists can insert it. It can stay in the bladder for 3 weeks up to 3 months, and it elutes gemcitabine into the urine and, you know, into the endothelium. So it's already approved, or it's been positive data in the Sunrise-1 study for non-muscle invasive BCG refractory disease. This was a study looking in muscle invasive disease that combined TAR-200 with an immune checkpoint inhibitor, a PD-1 inhibitor. And what we saw was actually a very similar, you know, pathologic CR rate actually to the Niagara study. You can see that there's some benefit in terms of recurrence-free survival. You know, it's modest. So technically this is a positive study. It's not the largest study. So, you know, I'm not really sure where this goes in the muscle invasive space, especially because the EVP data is looking very strong. So again, this is only a phase two trial. So the question is, will there be a phase three study? Is this the right place to put it? You know, you have modest efficacy, but maybe, you know, this efficacy may not be much better than what we're seeing with Gemcitabine. It is a sort of attractive because you don't have to give, you know, systemic chemotherapy. But I think we need to see perhaps, you know, in this larger study and, you know, with a control arm that, you know, a little more modern. So I'm not really sure where this goes, but it certainly has legs in the non-muscle invasive space.
And you'll notice again, here we go again, ctDNA looked pretty interesting in this study right. as well. Almost every time we, and now we get to the real ctDNA. This is one of the big, I think, papers of in oncology in recent years about ctDNA. You hear a lot about it, obviously, in colorectal cancer. This is pretty interesting data from the IMvigor study. So can you kind of go into this, Terry?
Sure. So IMvigor 011 is a follow-up to IMvigor 010. That was a study that looked at adjuvant atezolizumab for high-risk bladder cancer, so basically muscle-invasive bladder cancer. IMvigor 010 was negative in all comers, but a subset analysis showed that patients who were cell-free DNA positive after surgery benefited from getting atezolizumab. You can think of it as giving drug to patients who were destined to relapse. And so the investigators put together this study, IMvigor 011, which was a prospective study that assigned patients therapy based on whether or not they were cell-free DNA positive after surgery. It's important to note that this was using, again, the Signatera assay, so a bespoke assay. And they followed patients for up to a year after surgery. And at any point, if they turned positive, so this wasn't just one point, but it was for a full year, then they were assigned to get atezolizumab. So when these patients developed positivity, they got atezo. And you can see there was a clear benefit in terms of giving atezo to these early relapsing patients, almost like we just saw in the EMBARK study in prostate cancer. Earlier, more intensified therapy in patients who we know are relapsing is beneficial. And so that makes sense. It was great to see a prospective study that was using this biomarker to assign therapy. You know, we had a data update at AUA that showed that the patients who were cell-free DNA negative did okay. Only about 20% of them relapsed. So clearly this can help us sort of restratify patients and can tell us that, you know, if this turns positive, we need to start treating. I don't know if atezolizumab adjuvantly is going to be a major, you know, splash, considering we just talked about perioperative EVP. We've talked about combining, you know, IO with chemotherapy. So I think we'll have to see whether this gets filed, whether atezo becomes an adjuvant option. I'm just not sure which patient would get it. When we already have nivolumab and approved, and pembrolizumab also has a positive study in the space. But it really is showing us that using cell-free DNA has value. And I think, you know, there are a lot of unanswered questions, like if it turns positive and someone is already on therapy, should you be switching therapy, et cetera? I think there's still some unresolved questions there.
Pretty interesting, though, an adjuvant trial showing a survival benefit actually using this strategy. So pretty powerful. Right. A predictive factor. And you talked about adjuvant Nevo, and we also saw cell-free DNA data from the CheckMate 274 study. Again, can you kind of refresh our memory about the study, what it saw, sure. and what they specifically reported in terms of cell-free DNA?
Yeah, so this was the first of the adjuvant PD-1 studies in urothelial cancer to be positive. It was positive technically in all comers. It got an FDA approval for all comers with high-risk disease, so muscle-invasive or extravesicular node-positive disease. So this update at ESMO looked at a subset of patients in the trial who got also Signatera assay done post-operatively. Now, this was just done once, and it was only, as you can see, the numbers are kind of small there. This was only a fraction of the patients who were actually in the study, and it was really looking at the sort of predictor, the prognostic capability of cell-free DNA. And so what you see is that patients in red who were cell-free DNA positive immediately after surgery had a really terrible prognosis. Almost all of them relapsed with metastatic disease, regardless of whether or not they got, you know, therapy. the patients who were cell-free DNA negative did better. But as you can see, the curve is not, you know, at 100%. Actually, some of the patients who were cell-free DNA negative immediately after surgery did subsequently relapse. But you can clearly see there's a big difference between these two groups. So, you know, if the patient is cell-free DNA positive, that's a really bad sign. That's just like seeing a positive PSA immediately after prostatectomy. And that means that we really got to treat those patients. We got to do something. And that's what IMvigor011 told us. And that's true, as you see on the left, for recurrence as well as for survival. So it really highlights that, you know, cell-free DNA is a sort of a major biomarker for us in bladder cancer.
So I guess the other issue is when you use a bespoke assay like Signatera, which is really the assay that's been studied the most in these studies, it does take a little longer because it's individualized to the patient than a non-bespoke assay. Generally speaking, Terry, what type of assay are you using?
Yeah, so we've been using Signatera almost exclusively because it's bespoke. You know, I think that it provides a little more sensitivity for finding the recurrence. The other assays have not really been tested as well in prospective clinical trials, so we need to see how well they perform before, you know, using them, I think, in this way to, like, sort of assign therapy.
So maybe we can kind of skip over this case here. You have a 62-year-old patient, very interesting, with lymphovascular invasion where you did a Signatera assay that was negative. If you're interested, you can check out this paper in the slide set that goes into this question. This patient now actually turned positive, ends up getting treated because of that. Anything you want to say about this case and how cell-free DNA fit into this management case?
Yeah, I would say that the fact that cell-free DNA was negative made us much more comfortable doing surgery. Fortunately, this is a patient who I'm concerned may relapse. So, you know, they had surgery. As you can see, the cell-free DNA became negative immediately after surgery, quickly turned positive. So that's a poor prognostic sign. And because of that, I decided to give him adjuvant therapy, and we gave him the Niagara regimen as adjuvant. And, you know, you can see his cell-free DNA went back down to zero. I'm not sure he's going to get cured. I hope he does. But, you know, this has just told me that this guy is really high risk, sort of confirmed that he was high risk. And I think, you know, that can be helpful for thinking about what type of therapy to give.
So on Tuesday, we had the pleasure of working with Yelena Janjigian from a Memorial, a gastroesophageal investigator. And of course, we were talking lots about HER2-positive gastroesophageal. We talk about a lot of different, you know, lung cancer, HER2 mutant, HER2s all over the place, and including urothelial bladder cancer. At ESMO, we saw some data looking at dasatamab vedotin plus IO triplimab, and then TDXD, the Destiny Pan tumor 02 study. Terry, first of all, what did we see with dasatamab, and what do we know about its efficacy and tolerability?
Sure. So this is an ADC directed against HER2 with an MMAE payload, so actually very similar to enfortumab. This is a phase 3 trial that was done in China. The drug was developed in China, now is in a separate phase 3 study worldwide with pembrolizumab that's not yet reported. But this was the results of the Chinese study, and you can see on the graph the results speak for themselves. The hazard ratio here for PFS was 0.36, so really, really, you know, markedly positive. And the OS benefit was clear as well, 0.54. It's interesting, it almost parallels, the numbers are almost identical to what we see with EV and Pembro in the metastatic space. And so I think this really shows that targeting HER2 is beneficial. What I was most actually took away from this that wasn't, you know, really focused on in the study was that even patients with low-ish HER2 expression, meaning like HER2 1+, seem to benefit from getting this drug. And that suggests, you know, perhaps there's a bystander effect similar to what we see with TDXD in breast cancer. You know, I think everyone's sort of waiting for the worldwide study to read out to see if these results hold up. I think they probably will. You know, the payload is the same as EV. We know that MMAE is very active in bladder cancer, and it's up to, you know, 50 or 60% of patients have some degree of HER2 expression. In fact, my colleague at UCSF, Vadim Koshkin, just published a paper showing in about 2,000 patients that the HER2 is expressed in more than half of patients. So I think this is going to be a major, you know, new therapy for us. I do think the challenge is that, you know, this is being tested in the frontline setting in the same group of patients that would get enfortumab, vedotin, and pembrolizumab. And so, you know, it's hard to know which of those therapies we're going to give, you know, but that's a good problem to have, I think.
So I love the idea of a lowish HER2. You know, in breast cancer, they call it that we have a HER2 ultra low, where you still see responses, where you actually see responses to T-DXd, very pretty good responses, actually. And of course, now T-DXd is being looked at in many, many different cancers, IHC positive and HER2 mutant. What about this data in urothelial bladder cancer looking at T-DXd? Can you talk about what was presented and where things stand right now with the clinical use of T-DXd?
Yeah, sure. So DESTINY-PanTumor02 is a multi-arm study that looked at T-DXd across a number of different tumor types. You can see them on the right, including in urothelial bladder cancer. What we saw here is in orange that patients with 3+ HER2 expression had, you know, over 50% response rate. But, you know, as you can see, the lower numbers seem to respond okay as well. This garnered T-DXd a pan-cancer approval for HER2-high, for HER2-3+ cancers. This was the update, just looking at, you know, sort of PFS, et cetera. And, you know, I don't think this was necessarily earth-shaking update. You know, I think this is kind of what we expected. You know, PFS of about 3 months, OS of about a year. This is in very late line bladder cancer. It's been approved now for about a year already in the U.S. And I think about this in all of my patients who have HER2 disease. I test HER2 in every patient with metastatic bladder cancer, just like I do NGS to look for FGFR mutations and, you know, potentially other actionable mutations. I think HER2 should be tested in all bladder patients. And as we'll talk about in the case, you know, it has benefit. I've used it. I think a lot of folks who treat breast cancer probably used it more than me, but I think there's a role for it. Whether there's a role for it earlier on in the disease, you know, we'll have to see. There's not yet a phase three trial of this like planned in urothelial cancer, but it's already an option based on that approval.
So, of course, at ASCO, we saw first-line T-DXd in breast cancer, now going to be standard of care HER2 positive. And then at ESMO, neoadjuvant and post-neoadjuvant T-DXd. And we'll see whether or not in other cancers we've kind of followed suit. Raina, just kind of curious what your experience has been with tolerability with T-DXd. One thing I hear people talking about is acute GI side effects. I wonder what you're seeing with your patients. And also, of course, the issue of ILD in breast cancer. They're very meticulous about getting scans and looking, trying to diagnose it early. What's your experience been with bladder cancer, T-DXd, Raina?
Yeah, you know, I actually think it's a pretty well-tolerated regimen. I have to say, I have a patient who had a cancer of unknown primary that we actually thought was potentially a urothelial that was HER2 positive, and but she had platinum first off as her treatment, and then when she ultimately progressed, she had kind of nodal disease and didn't have a primary in place. We did T-DXd with Keytruda, actually, and she had a dramatic response. She's actually off therapy now and had a dramatic response. She's like NED, tolerated treatment well, you know, and so I think I do think that there's going to be a place for systematic, you know, testing and use, and I'm excited to see more bladder-specific data be presented and actually thinking about how do we, you know, you know, what do you do in the context of somebody who's HER2 positive frontline? What's the right choice? I think that's going to be a critical decision. Like if you have EV Pembro, you know, which ADC do you target based off of what's going on in the tumor?
It's really cool. After years of hearing people present cases of breast cancer, now I'm hearing it. I did a meeting at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting on HER2 positive gyn cancer. We had these docs, you know, who for the first time were seeing a response to T-DXd, and I love the smile that's on people's face because sometimes it can be, as your patient, very impressive. So ADC plus IO immunotherapy is pretty hot nowadays. Last night we were talking about this is now first-line therapy of triple-negative breast cancer and IO plus the ADC. We saw there's a TROP2 ADC datopotamab approved in breast cancer, ER-positive breast cancer, but with a really interesting bispecific rivlegostamib. Can you talk about what this is, Terry, what they saw, and where you think things are heading there?
Yeah, so this was looking at, you know, adding immunotherapy that targets TIGIT as well as PD-1. It's a bispecific checkpoint inhibitor. This is a really small study, right? This is a total of 40 patients. But you can see actually fairly good response with Dato-DXd, which is a TROP2 targeting, Topo 1 payload. Dato-DXd is going into larger studies and phase 3 trials as monotherapy. So this was sort of an offshoot looking at whether there was a value to adding the immunotherapy in the TIGIT. There's no control arm here, so it's hard to know, in this small study, were these responses due to the immune therapy? Were they due to the Dato? TIGIT has not really panned out across oncology. There was a negative phase 3 trial in lung. We published a negative study in the Morpheus trial in bladder cancer. So we really have to see where that goes. But I think that Dato-DXd has a good, sort of path forward, especially because sacituzumab govitecan lost its FDA approval based on a negative phase 3 study that had a lot of myelosuppression and neutropenic deaths. So I think if they can develop Dato-DXd correctly, there's maybe a role for it in later line disease.
So one final paper or comment from Terry. Again, as an oncologist, always curious about management of non-muscle invasive disease. Of course, we had IOs, pembrolizumab coming in there in the past. And here we have an IO durvalumab combined with BCG, kind of interesting concept, the Potomac trial. Terry, what did they see there and what do you think it means?
Yeah, so this is in totally treatment naive patients. Frontline therapy, standard treatment for non-muscle invasive diseases, just BCG. So this is a randomized phase 3 adding durvalumab to BCG. I think patients got 2 years of therapy. They saw survival benefit. This actually mirrors what was seen in the CREST trial, which is a study of sasanlimab, which is a subcutaneous PD-1 inhibitor that was presented earlier this year. So we have two positive phase 3 studies that show that adding a checkpoint inhibitor results in DFS benefit, but there's not a survival benefit here. And I think this actually generated a lot of questions. Is there a role for this? The toxicity rate was, in the order of grade 3 toxicity was in the order of, 20%. The magnitude of benefit here is about 8%, and there's no of DFS, and there's no survival benefit. So yes, technically a positive study. I'm not sure, where this will go. I think urologists are interested in giving this when they start patients out on therapy, but I think we have to be really careful about the immune-related toxicity, especially when this is being given by surgeons and not necessarily by immunologists or medical oncologists who have a lot more experience. So we'll see where this sort of goes.
That's a great, very practical point. So Raina and Terry, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Raina. Thanks, Terry.
Well, thank you.
Have a good one.
Yeah, thanks, Neil.
Fantastic.